So this morning, we have returned again to a place where many of us feel our soul is amplified, comforted, connected to other souls. The Unitarian Universalist congregation. That means a lot. My topic today is, where do you come from? Where does Unitarian Universalist come from? Some folks like to think Unitarians and Universalists are a modern cult. That's what I heard from my sister's churches. She's an evangelical Christian coming out of the Southern Baptist Church where she and I spent several years together, and she stayed, and I decided I needed to move on. Had a nice book talking about the Unitarian cult that she shared with me because she was concerned about the nature of my soul, the future of my soul. And I appreciate her sincerity of wanting someone she loved to be in a place of comfort in eternity. But we know it's more than a modern cult. And it's more than the relatively recent merger of 1961 of the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church of America, which was accomplished in 1961 after 50 years of negotiation. We Unitarians and Universalists don't want to do anything too quickly in organization. We have to talk about it a lot. But other folks look back to the religious leaning Humanist Manifesto of 1933, which had 10 Unitarian and Universalist ministers among the 34 signatures. They were at the forefront of what actually was a modern movement toward amplification of the understanding of the human influence, not some divine other. Others of us focus our attention on the transcendentalists, like Emerson and Henry David Thoreau and Margaret Fuller, and their published essays dating back to the 1840s. Many of us find our connection with the divine, with the inutterable permanence of the world in our experience of nature, as Natalie was expressing a few moments ago. And many of us are very proud of the prominent roles of Unitarians, especially over the past 200 years, as leaders who were important participants in the founding of the NAACP, the United Nations, the American Civil Liberties Union, Urban League, Planned Parenthood, Interfaith Alliance, environmentalist groups, various abolitionist organizations to end slavery in the 19th century, American public schools, starting in Massachusetts, organizations like PFLAG, promoting acceptance of gays, lesbians, transgender folks. And this is the weekend of celebration of transgender rights. And obviously, the continuing engagement with women's movements, including the movement that almost accomplished the adoption of the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1960s and 70s. These social justice and social welfare causes of all different kinds uniformly show higher participation of Unitarians and Universalists than any other denomination for our size, proportionally. But historically, Unitarian and Universalist arguments about interpretations of the nature of God and Jesus and life and death and what comes after life all came from many generations, hundreds and thousands of years. Among the Christians, the earliest followers actually debated the nature of God and elements of doctrine, which actually were created over the hundreds of years by rulers and bishops across Europe and North Africa nearly 2,000 years ago. And it wasn't until the Council of Bishops in Nicaea, called together by Emperor Constantine in the 4th century, that the Unitarian heresy was determined that there was the nature of God, according to the official Christian dogma and doctrine, was three rather than one. But we could also reference different forms of Unitarian type of thought from much earlier times. Perhaps one pharaoh's concept of the sun god, which he termed as Aten, was basically a kind of Unitarian perspective from 2,400 or more years back. And we know that the Jewish insistence on one God separated them from later Egyptian views of multiple entities with unique divine aspects, multiplicity of gods. Much later, the 8th century prophet Muhammad rejected the tribal conceptions of multiple divinities after receiving the message called the Quran, he said, directly from Allah. In centers of biblical study in Spain, France, Hungary, Italy, Poland, and elsewhere, the radical reformation of Calvinism was carried even further, persisting among various scholars and priests in the centuries following the Catholic Inquisition, the Protestant Reformation of Martin Luther, and the Catholic Counter-Reformation. And all of these were, of course, followed by the purely personal and political English Reformation of Henry VIII, who wanted a divorce and the Pope wouldn't give it to him, which that created the Anglican Church of the 16th century. American Unitarians and Universalists have a long and complex history arising out of all of this, but also specifically from the Anglican traditions in Britain, where the traditional church doctrine of hell as eternal punishment for original sin was interpreted as contrary to Jesus' message of God's ultimate love. These separatists and Puritans began to break away from the main line of Christianity, Judeo-Christian heritage. And the formerly Anglican Methodist preacher John Murray adopted this universalist message not long before he was forced to board a ship from his home in England to migrate to America after his wife and son died and he was released from debtor's prison. He consistently expressed his conviction that God would not condemn any of his children to hell. During the earlier Great Migration of the 1630s, the English Puritans, 20,000 of them, came and settled in New England primarily and established independent neighborhood churches. They called them parishes. They practiced congregational polity, that form of church governance in which members of each local church are united by signing their own covenant. Most of those covenants were very short. The primary part of the covenant of the Salem, Massachusetts Church, written in 1629, even before Boston was founded, was, "We covenant with the Lord and one another, and do bind ourselves to walk together in all his ways." But the Puritans' ultimate religious authority came solely from that convincing power of truth in the understandings they reached and tested over time by a group of loving individuals mutually pledged faithfully to seek and to heed the truth together in ongoing community. That's much like your purpose and your covenant in this congregation. Not surprisingly, that is a continuing heritage. But therefore, although they were technically Anglicans, those Puritans rejected the authority of the bishops or the king from anyone other than the local church. Each church elected and ordained its own ministers and lay leaders, just as you do. All of those churches together formed a sort of loose union called the Standing Order, or the New England Way, a community of independent churches, each governed solely by the decision of its own members, yet in fellowship with other churches. Much as you have voluntarily become part of our East Coast region of the Unitarian Universalist Association, it's a voluntary joining of churches and individuals who share many values, but you are not obligated to follow anything that those organizations recommend or offer as options. In practical terms, the fellowship of these kind of churches means that ministers in the past frequently exchanged pulpits, traveling all over their region to do so. It meant that members traveled readily and often to participate in other churches' ordinations, building dedications, and funerals, the major events of congregational life. And that kind of fellowship also meant then and now that a troubled congregation unable to resolve some conflict could always ask for advice from sister churches to send ministerial or lay leaders to meet in council, to consider the options, to consider what might be done. And so leaders from neighboring churches would assemble to hear all sides of a dispute and offer not a ruling but advice, which a church often agreed to accept. But each congregation, as you are, is complete in itself and completely guarded against interference. But those shiploads of immigrants from England had a calling to reconstitute on the biblical pattern of liberty. 10 years after the Plymouth Colony was established by separatists, not Puritans, separatists who were persecuted because they refused to go along with the Anglican tradition, the Puritans' governor-elect John Winthrop preached to his fellow passengers aboard the Arbella, one of the first groups of ships to set sail for New England in 1630, and his sermon was titled A Model of Christian Charity. He declared that with the eyes of all people upon them, they must be knit together in the bonds of love, and a city upon the hill, which became Boston, might inspire emulation by other communities. But even with their careful design and practice, the Puritans could not maintain a perfectly ordered society. They argued with intensity and bitterness whether or not people who live righteously demonstrated the necessary state of grace. The church leaders affirmed in writing in a document called the Cambridge Platform a few years after they landed on New England shores that no organization of churches could not dictate to individual churches. But the Puritan churches did affirm the Calvinist theological doctrines of God and salvation from the Anglican Church they knew so well. This was a transitory phase where they couldn't separate completely from the theology that they had seen back in England. And that was because the earliest Puritan settlers were a self-selected group whose main battle had been to win freedom from control by the king and bishops, whom they saw as corrupt. But at the same time, as the economy of New England grew, it exerted a moderating influence on religious life in New England. The merchants belonged not only to the congregations, but the international trading community as well. They felt that in markets abroad, they worked at a disadvantage because there was a stigma of intolerance attached to anyone from New England, just like now. And the Puritan ideal called upon New England folks to take care of the community interests rather than to profit from others' sacrifice. The Puritan laws, in effect for many years, put restrictions on the amount of profit that traders were allowed to realize in their sale transactions. A few store owners were even prosecuted and fined for charging too much. But the early New England businessmen, finding they could not operate under this kind of rigorous Puritan regime, either returned to England or brought in Anglican counterparts to conduct the business for them. And those Anglicans, who were not Puritans, were able to charge what they felt the traffic would bear. And therefore, New England got much richer, much faster. And the Puritan authority lost its power against that uncontrolled capitalist behavior, which was common everywhere else. But by 1700, the balance of power was shifting when the group of Boston merchants, who were fresh Anglican imports, successfully called for the organization of a more tolerant Anglican church, which they could attend without fear of condemnation for their business practices. Ironically, though, their new King's Chapel, fully Anglican, became the first explicitly Unitarian church in America less than 90 years later, when they called a young minister who told them that Unitarianism was much more likely to be, in God's sight, a better religion. Fascinating how that occurred. But over the first half of this 18th century, the old Puritan confidence in individual conscience was strengthened by new ideas in science and philosophy, in particular the writings of Isaac Newton and John Locke. The Congregationalists and many others saw in Newton's orderly universe the scientific method, the work of God. And from John Locke, they learned that all ideas come from experience, and they could envision the potential for continuous redevelopment of the human mind, including both ethics and morality. It was this enlightenment, intellectual enlightenment, which was throughout Europe, which ushered in the openness which made truly Unitarian thought possible and acceptable among a broader public. And so by the close of that 18th century, many of the largest churches, especially in eastern Massachusetts, had ministers and lay ministers who were openly Unitarian. To these liberals and to the founding fathers of our country, freedom of choice was both a reality of common experience and arising from the goodness of God. They rejected, as even unbiblical, the experience of Calvinist doctrines that humanity would be forever cursed by the original sin of Adam and Eve. It just wasn't logical. And they also went to that Unitarian foundation and said the idea of God as Trinity was absurd. If there's a God, there must be one God. And so they adopted positive doctrines of the possibility of continuing moral, spiritual, and intellectual growth. And since this evolution over time of a distinctly liberal theology was gradual, it was not perceived by the people of the time as truly an innovation, but a natural development in both biblical understanding and societal support. They didn't think it was helpful to argue about this with their more orthodox neighbors. If they came to this conclusion, they said, well, we know the truth. If you don't want to talk about it, you know, it's okay. We're not trying to convince you. So they've been non-evangelical from 200 years back. And that's one of the reasons that we're even now slightly reticent to share our perspective on what faith is for us. But in response to the new liberal influence, some more orthodox churches began to insert their creed statements, statements of belief, into their covenants, while the more liberal churches insisted on freedom of belief. And this tug of war between the two sides was very evident in both the Universalist churches and the Unitarian churches, where some wanted the assurance of saying, if I'm part of this church, I want people to believe like me. And others who were saying, I want the freedom to believe whatever I want, and therefore I don't want any creedal statement in my covenant. But ministers holding those quite divergent theologies continued to exchange pulpits and members, and members continued to be glad to hear them until after the turn of the century, when the Harvard Divinity School Board appointed the liberal Henry Ware to an endowed professorship in the Divinity School. The Calvinists, the ones who wanted creeds, wanted to talk about Jesus. They wanted to talk about the resurrection. They wanted to talk about virgin birth. The Calvinists said, if we're going to have a Unitarian in the Harvard Divinity School, we don't want to be any part of that. We want our ministers to be trained in conventional Christian ways. So they organized their own seminary, Andover Theological Seminary, only a few miles away in 1808. That school, by the way, 200 years later, is merging with the other Calvinist school that still remains. It's called Yale. Yale Divinity School and Andover School are going to be one after this May, because the Andover folks have figured it out that they can't support another sort of progressive Christian theological school. They want to have the concentration of resources in Yale. And that's a fascinating development that's been coming along the last 10 years, but now it's happening. In 1815, one Calvinist named Jedediah Morris published a critical article with the title American Unitarianism, which was a pejorative description, a negative. It suggested that liberal ministers were dishonestly disguising their real theology and were, in fact, full-fledged Unitarians and therefore should be separated from the body of true Christians. Those ministers were invited less and less often into the pulpits of the Calvinist churches, and then not at all. Many liberals, including William Ellery Channing, tried to minimize that conflict. But by 1819, with the support and provocation of a couple of dozen younger ministers, Channing decided it was time to make a clean break. He was invited to present the ordination sermon for a promising young minister at the new Baltimore Church, which still stands on the central square in Baltimore. He called this speech, his sermon, American Unitarian Christianity. So he wanted to make sure he enveloped both names, American and Unitarian and Christian, all three names. And that became the most widely circulated pamphlet of those times. Tens of thousands of copies were sent around to a lot of places throughout America and elsewhere. And this resulted in the formation of the American Unitarian Association of Ministers just a few years later in 1825. Now, the Calvinist Congregationalists, the ones who wanted the creed, they wanted to be explicitly about Jesus' virgin birth and the resurrection and the Trinity of God, insisted that members must agree about doctrine, including the nature of God, human nature, and salvation. The original sin thing is human nature, and salvation requiring belief in Jesus and the sacrifice of Jesus. Liberal Unitarians insisted just as strongly that their church covenant would embrace anyone who wanted to try to live an ethical life in the community of like-minded folk. But liberals and Calvinists couldn't even agree on what to argue about. And so they argued about everything, especially about polity. And so eventually the argument became who would own the communion silver and the building when they split up. Because they did. They split up. Many churches did split, with some members remaining and others leaving to organize a new congregation, sometimes 50 feet around the corner. And there's many Unitarian and United Church of Christ churches now, which are on the town square together on adjacent corners. In general, the church was called Unitarian. If most of the members now had a Harvard graduate in their pulpit, it was probably Calvinist if a minister was a graduate of Andover or Yale. Eventually, about 250 of New England's original First Parish churches formally took the name Unitarian, including the church founded in 1717, which I served for 9 years near Plymouth, as well as the Plymouth congregation itself, the Congregation of the Pilgrims of 1620, where I have also preached several times by invitation. That congregation literally is going back 400 years in just, another couple of years. Now, over the past 200 years of Unitarian identity, scholars have documented not only our Judeo-Christian roots, but our connection to world religions, how the Hindu philosopher Tagore introduced the Unitarian-type thought into the Brahmo Samaj community of Hinduism in India, the formation of a specifically Unitarian community in Northeast India, which has thousands of members, as well as a large Unitarian community in the Philippines. We have also seen how certain Buddhist sects in Japan have been mutually influential with Unitarian thought and have actually come to a very compassionate and congruent kind of impression about how to conduct services and the meaning of what's going on in their religious ceremonies. We know that the experience of Norbert Chapek, who came to the United States originally as a Christian Baptist minister and who discovered, I think in either Cherry Hill or one of the New Jersey congregations, Unitarian thought and became a Unitarian minister who went back to Czechoslovakia and created the largest Unitarian community in the world in the 1920s as he celebrated the new nationalist fervor of Czechoslovakia with the new Unitarian religious thought that was not dominated either by the state or by an external power like the Pope, and has been celebrated since World War II for his sacrifice in speaking out against the Nazis. And we also know how all of these different cultures are now being how our national identity is coming to a place where we feel threatened. You see movies about the threats of aliens coming from way out in outer space, and that we have to treat them as enemies because they surely want to conquer us. This is not a new vein in an American culture. This is something that's become even more accentuated over the past 30, 40 years again, after a period of our trying to be more inclusive, more global in our thinking. But recently we are seeing how people think that whoever is different from us must be threatening to those of us who are here already. So where do Unitarian and Universalists really come from? We come from the consciences and consciousness of radicals who refuse to go along to get along. We affirm the ideals of universalism, a universalism which accepts and embraces diversity of convictions about equal human rights, despite differences of race or ethnicity or sexual expression or gender expression. We come from a tradition that has always emphasized openness to more, more emphasis on the ultimate worth of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in healthy, mutually supportive community. We are so fortunate to be part of a heritage and to benefit from the heritage, and so that we can show our children and grandchildren that there is no necessity for us to feel threatened by people who are different, that we can look for commonalities, we can look for shared experience, we can look for shared values with people who appear to be somewhat different from us because of our different sets of priorities that we have brought from other nations and other ethnicities and other expressions of humanity. We are at the cutting edge, and we have been for hundreds of years, especially in the American experience. Our Unitarian and Universalist heritage is something to treasure, and I hope that you will, with me, welcome, for example, next week, our transgender speaker, who will be talking about the incredible importance of the Equality Virginia organization and other organizations like the Human Rights Campaign, that we are at the forefront of promoting acceptance and embrace of those who appear to be different from us in ways that don't really matter. And we can emphasize what we can do to give as an example our lives in this community and in communities throughout our nation, that life is something we share and we benefit from the diversity of folks who bring their differences to share with us, not as threats, but as enrichment. I don't know about you, but I'm glad that I found Unitarian Universalism and that I have made the choice and have brought my family to experience and embrace Unitarian Universalism as both a religious identity and an attitude about how to be in the world. Thank you for your attention this morning. Our closing song this morning is Building a New Way, number 1017. We're trying to stay in the blue hymnal today, even though sometimes it's tough, right, Dave? Please stand as you're willing and able and sing together, number 1017.